You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 9th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Leah Stokes, professor of climate and energy policy at the University of California, Santa Barbara, on assessing the Inflation Reduction Act's climate provisions. Meanwhile, the FBI raids Mar-a-Lago looking for something.
Mara documents.
This means war. Deep state. QAnon foretold it. House to return from recess on Friday for the day to vote for that Inflation Reduction Act. Meanwhile, Alex Jones' text messages turned over to the January 6th committee. And the average price of gas drops below $4. Let's go, Brandon. Giuliani looking to delay the Georgia grand jury testimony they are requiring of him. And it's primary day in Connecticut, Minnesota, Vermont, and Wisconsin. Go vote. Biden administration says remain in Mexico policy to end or has ended. And in Florida, polls show Ron DeSantis under 50%. Not necessarily trailing anybody, but he is an incumbent under 50% in a possibly tightening Senate race. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Tuesday, August 9th. Joining me in celebrating my daughter's birthday on today's program. Oh. Happy birthday, Myla, is Emma Vigeland.
Happy birthday, Myla. I thought you were going to say joining me in celebrating the FBI raid on Trump's home. That too.
I don't want to get overly excited about that.
Well, I mean, it's fun.
It is fun.
We could use some fun.
And as QAnon foretold, what happens next is like something.
The
like
storm.
Phase
storm.
One is complete.
The storm is here.
The storm is here, ladies and gentlemen, so buckle up. Apparently, Steven Crowder is going to war over this.
I'm worried about Steve. He needs to do some breathing exercises.
He's
good
strapped.
Thing he has that gun.
Exactly. He's going to be shooting everybody in his
He's having a panic
today.
Attack. He's got two guns on his chest.
I have to take it out of the holster. Whew. I never thought this day would come.
He slept with it under his pillow last night and stroked it mightily. Just in anticipation of needing to use it, of course.
For war day.
That's right. You need to get the gun turgid, I believe. Somebody can fire. Here is a statement from Donald Trump yesterday. Save America is his new stationery. I don't think I had noticed that, actually. President Donald J. Trump, really technically former president, but let's not split hairs. This is a statement by Donald J. Trump, and he writes, "These are dark times for our nation." Can we scroll up? As my beautiful home, Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida, is currently under siege, raided, and occupied by a large group of FBI agents. Incidentally, also beautiful golf course. Nothing like this has ever happened to a president of the United States before. I mean...
But then he goes on to compare it to Nixon.
Right. Yeah, well... That's,
right?
Look, don't question my writing. After working and cooperating with the relevant government agencies, this unannounced raid on my home was not necessary or appropriate. It is prosecutorial misconduct. the weaponization of the justice system.
He would know nothing about that.
By capital R, radical left, capital L, capital D, Democrats, who desperately don't want me to run for president in 2024, especially based on recent polls, and who will likewise do anything to stop Republicans and conservatives in the upcoming midterm elections. Such an assault could only take place in a broken third world countries.
Got a grammar agreement problem there.
But it's okay.
It's, I mean, not to split hairs, but you inserted the A.
Oh,
Sam,
okay. So well, whatever.
Look who's the dummy now.
Sadly, not America has now become one of those countries corrupt at a level not seen before. They even broke into my safe! Exclamation point. What is the difference between this and Watergate, where operatives broke into the Democratic National Committee?
Democrat.
One, that was a criminal break-in.
Right, that was performed.
This was done with the approval of a judge.
Right, that was performed without a warrant by people who were just criminals. Just burglars.
That's
not
the difference.
Intelligence guys.
That's the difference. That's one of the...
At also the direction of the president.
One was a crime. One was in search of evidence of a crime.
Yes.
Here, in reverse, Democrats broke into the home of the 45th president of the United States.
That's me.
Was it Democrats? Was it like... It's like Chris Murphy.
Yeah. Bob Menendez there with...
AOC had a drill and was drilling into the safe. The political persecution of Donald J. Trump... Wait, what's going up here? The political persecution of Donald J. Trump has been going on for years, with now fully debunked Russia scam.
That's a good reference to the Brady Bunch and his freaking...
Marsha.
Impeachment hoax number one, impeachment hoax number two, and so much more, it just never ends. It's political targeting at the highest level. Hillary Clinton was allowed to delete an acid wash 33,000 emails after they were subpoenaed by Congress. Absolutely nothing has happened to hold her accountable. She even took antique furniture and other items from the White House.
Whoa.
And she's stinky, too.
I stood up to America's bureaucratic corruption. I restored power to the people and truly delivered for our country like we have never seen before. I'm the one. Okay, we're back. Apologize for the slight break in our programming. Our power went out. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Dr. Leah Stokes, professor of climate and energy policy at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Cedar and Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Dr. Leah Stokes. She is a professor of climate and energy policy at the University of California, Santa Barbara, here to give us an assessment on the Inflation Reduction Act's climate provisions. Leah, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
Let's just start with the top line numbers, okay? And compare it relative to Build Back Better, the initial numbers. This is in Build Back Better. There was a specific, part of the bill that was really a meant to address climate change. Before we even get into the numbers, like, how is it meant to address climate change? Like, literally, how is it meant to do so?
Sure. So you want me to talk about Build Back Better as opposed to the where we ended up today?
Well, I mean, I guess the idea is in both of those, in both iterations,
yes.
Right? The theory of addressing climate change is the same. Maybe there are certain things that have been reduced or eliminated,
yes.
But I'm looking for when we say climate provisions, like what exactly are we trying to do with those? Yeah.
Great question. So basically what this approach, this policy approach has been is a bunch of carrots to try to move us towards clean energy. It's helpful to break it down into buckets. The first bucket is really consumer-facing support. So you want to get an electric vehicle, there's support to help you do that. And the good thing is it's actually point of sale. So when you go to the dealership, that'll come right off the sticker price. And it also works for used vehicles for the first time. So that's a really big deal. And getting an electric vehicle is great when it comes to fighting inflation because it costs $1 a gallon if you have an EV to operate compared to $4, $5, or $6 a gallon for a gas-powered car. And there's also consumer-facing incentives for heat pumps, great technology to help you cool and heat your home with electricity, heat pump hot water heaters for low-income Americans, induction stoves to help get gas out of our home. So there are basically some consumer-facing supports to help people get clean technologies. The second big bucket is huge amounts of support to deploy clean energy technologies and clean up our electricity system. So there are long-term extensions of these tax credits that have been critical to building out wind and solar in this country. And there's going to be a new tax credit to build out batteries, which is great news for the grid. And then in addition to that, there's $30 billion to clean up the grid. And I'll just say two other quick buckets. There's about $60 billion each for clean manufacturing in the United States and for environmental justice investments. And both of those provisions are about really trying to change our economy, making it more equitable and equal in terms of the environmental justice provisions and, you know, making clean energy jobs here in the United States in terms of those manufacturing provisions.
Okay. So, and let me, I want to even ask like a before we get into the sort of the details of those different buckets, the point is for us to generate less carbon emissions, right? I mean, ultimately,
yes.
That's, I mean, talk about it on that level first, because
sure.
I'm not sure that people who just hear this stuff, they hear, you know, $370 billion towards climate as opposed to $550 billion towards climate. I don't think that most people really understand what that means other than one number is bigger than the other and aren't even clear on what the goals are associated with that. So talk like very, very top line goals for us.
Great question. You know, the fact is that burning fossil fuels causes climate change, and we burn fossil fuels in all parts of our economy. And so what the bill is trying to do is help everyday Americans burn less fossil fuels, which is not just good for the planet. It's good for their health because it reduces indoor air pollution. And it's also good for their pocketbooks because it reduces their energy costs. In fact, one report from Rewiring America suggests that if an average household adopts the clean energy technologies that this bill will make more affordable, they'll actually save $1,800 a year in energy costs. So, you know, when we talk about inflation, it really is a lot to do with fossil fuels. So, you know, that's the goal here. And that's just an example on the sort of personal household level in terms of getting off of fossil fuels. But we use fossil fuels, as people know, to generate electricity, right? For our transportation sector, for our industry. And so what this bill does is across all the different sectors of the economy, it helps us reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. That's, again, great for inflation because so much of inflation is about fossil fuels. And it's also great for the planet and for our health because fossil fuels are very dirty and they're destabilizing our planet. So what's the big takeaway? This bill, according to estimates from three independent modeling groups, this bill will cut carbon pollution by about 40% below 2005 levels by 2030. Okay, what does that mean? Why do we care? Well, scientists say we have to cut carbon pollution by about 50%, by about half by 2030, if we want to try to limit warming to 1.5 degrees, okay? President Biden has said he wants to cut carbon pollution by half, by 50%, so that we can meet that scientific target. And this bill is going to help us get to 40%. In other words, it's going to help us get 80% of the way there. So that's why it's really important. It really starts getting us on a pathway to tackle the climate crisis.
Where, as that metric, 40 versus 50% of the way, where would the original of Build Back Better
yes.
gotten us in terms of that goal? And we should say, you know, we still have another 8 years. But now we're like in one step, we're at 40% as opposed to maybe subsequent steps that could theoretically get us that other 10%. But what would have been the difference if we had Build Back Better?
Great question. So the estimates at that time were 45%, right? Meaning we would have gotten 90% of the way to our goal. So that would have been better. We kind of wouldn't get like an A or an A minus or something like that. Now we're getting more like a B. But hey, a B is way better than an F, as we all know, right? That's what we're at. And you make such a good point, Sam. You know, what this bill will do is start making a big down payment on the climate issue. And we've only got those 8 years, like you said, till 2030. So how can we get that last 10%? Well, states can do more. So for example, Governor Newsom in California passed a bill just last month with $54 billion in clean energy and climate investments. And they're talking about doing more. Of course, Governor Inslee in Washington State has been on the bleeding edge of this. Activists in New York City banned gas and new construction at the end of last year, and they're trying to do it for the whole state. So, you know, that's the action that we need at the state and local level to really build on this federal investment. But without the federal investment, it's kind of like the foundation, right? The federal government has so much money that it can spend compared to states or cities. And so this gives us a great foundation that we can build on with more actions at the state and local level.
I don't want to get too mired in the modeling because, frankly, I'm not smart enough to make assessments of that. And I'm not sure that it really, you know, I mean, I think at one point in this process, one needs to, you know, I know there's multiple organizations that have come in from 38% to, you know, 40% in terms of what it will do in terms
or
of reduction.
42%, or 42%. High end, yeah.
So 40% is sort of like the aggregate of all of these. But when they model, like just how much is projection based upon assumptions that this is going to get the ball rolling in a certain way. I mean, I can only use a metaphor for this, that the ball is going to start to roll and there's a certain amount of, as the slope goes down with the ball, that there's going to be an acceleration in the rate of that rolling of the ball, which will get the ball to the end line faster or not faster. And so I guess how much of that is associated with this? In other words, like when we talk about, okay, maybe there's more uptake of electric cars than we assume, and that's going to have implications. Or maybe there is some type of tipping point where the cost of wind and solar becomes so low and other factors increase the cost associated with drilling that it has an exponential sort of effect that is either presumed in these models or not presumed in these models, I guess.
Yeah, so that's some good metaphorical modeling you just did on the fly there, Sam. Nicely done. That's kind of how these models work, exactly. And different models incorporate different things. So, for example, what about incorporating innovation in the models? That's not something that people generally do, but let me just explain what that means. When we build more heat pumps, when we build more electric vehicles, more solar panels, more wind turbines, what happens? Their cost falls. People know this, right? We built more computers, they got cheaper. We built more cell phones, they got cheaper. And so as we build, and more powerful too, right? So the cost per like unit of computing is way less than it was when we first invented a computer. So that's the same for clean energy technologies. And what this bill is going to do is deploy so much, let's say batteries, right? And then the cost of a battery is going to fall. And as the cost of a battery falls, guess what? It's more competitive with dirty, expensive now, quite frankly, fossil fuels, right? And so that's part of the momentum that you're talking about. And some of these models incorporate that learning and some of them don't even, to be honest. So, you know, what they're basically trying to understand is like, how does this bill make clean energy cheaper and therefore compete with fossil fuels? You've got to make assumptions about what the cost of fossil fuels are going to be too, right? Because fossil fuels right now are actually quite expensive, which is why if you buy an EV, you can actually save money the very first month you operate it. And that's before we talk about the subsidies and the support that just passed in the bill. Because guess what? If it costs $1 a gallon to operate versus 4, 5, or 6, think about how quickly that adds up into savings, right? So yes, what this bill basically does is it starts to deploy massive amounts of clean energy. Clean energy is now cheap energy. It's going to compete against fossil fuels, and that's going to really turn the tide in terms of how we power our society. Are we powering it on dirty fossil fuels that, you know, pollute and poison communities that destabilize our planet? Or are we powering it on cheap and clean energy? And what this bill does is it makes clean energy even cheaper.
I'm hearing a lot about, you know, electric vehicles, right? And I'm in complete support of that as a transition away from fossil fuels. But when I hear that, I think that's a ton of lithium mining, and that's going to be an exponential increase in that kind of mining and potentially the environmental impacts that come from that. Has your organization considered some of those impacts, or what are other environmentalists saying about the potential there?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And certainly there are folks who focus on lithium mining. It's not my area of expertise. You know, I think that people don't fully understand the amount of extraction and mining and sheer volume of stuff we're talking about with fossil fuels. And so the status quo in terms of extraction of dirty stuff from the earth is like exponentially larger than lithium. And that isn't to say anything about lithium being problematic and the importance of creating good supply chains and good labor practices. And, you know, there, that will be a thing that has to be monitored to manage, right? All solutions, all energy solutions have good parts to them and bad parts to them. You know, a wind turbine is made out of steel. Steel is a very energy intensive process, you know. We could say things about solar panels too. So look, there are environmental impacts for all material objects in the world, but it's easy to forget how much the material impact of fossil fuels are. So think about it. If you've got a gas-powered car, every time you drive anywhere, you need to take materials from the earth and put it in your car. You then burn those materials and you don't see them, but they are going into the atmosphere. They're going into the oceans. They are totally destabilizing our planet, and they're also polluting you. Think about how you could close your garage door and murder yourself if you sat in with a car burning, right? Because this is toxic stuff that we are putting into the air. And it's interesting. There's actually all these new scientific studies that show that burning gas in our homes is actually very bad for our health. It increases the risk of childhood asthma by 42%. And even when your gas stove is turned off, it's leaking. It's leaking gas into your home that includes things like benzene, which is a carcinogen. So, you know, part of the fossil fuel economy and its health impacts are not fully understood by people, but they are really, really bad. And they are also very materially intensive because you have to keep taking more and more and more fossil fuels out of the ground, right? Like every time you drive your car, you need more fossil fuels to power it. Versus a lithium battery, it is a material thing. It does have an impact, but you mine it once, you stick it in your car, and then you have it for a long time. And actually, electric vehicles don't lose their value as much. They have a they have a longer lifetime than a gas-powered car. And part of the bill actually includes pretty strong incentives for recycling of lithium too. So, you know, the lithium issue is going to be a growing environmental issue for sure, but we cannot discount the present massive costs of fossil fuels, not just to the planet, but also to our own health and the health of communities who are living by these extraction sites.
Okay. So, and I mean, I suspect we can't also anticipate like the sort of, you know, I imagine it's not, let's put it this way. It's not hard to imagine that we're going to replicate the same sort of extractive, imperialistic policies that we have pursued relative to oil, but it's just going to change in terms of like what it is that we're looking after here. But I think, you know, the near term sort of like emergency is getting rid of carbon. Or limiting our carbon production ultimately, or the emissions that we're putting out, I should say. And so, with that also in mind, relative from Build Back Better, $550 billion. This is $370 billion, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. What? Let's just start with the, sort of the broad. What was the approach in terms of cutting it? Was it, we have 10 silos of things in Build Back Better. We're going to have, I don't know, 7, I guess, like percentage-wise, as opposed to 10. Or was it we're going to keep the 10 and we're just going to reduce the funding for each of those 10 by 25%?
Yeah, so obviously I didn't choose what went forward or didn't, but Senator Manchin and Senator Schumer were the ones negotiating that. you know, my understanding is that Senator Manchin had specific demands of things he wanted to add to the bill, things he wanted to take out of the bill. And, you know, he was really a veto player, as we say in political science. He had a veto, right? And so his voice was very powerful. I think where Senator Schumer's team is concerned, they really prioritized, I would say, two things from my understanding. One was making sure we got as much pollution cuts out of this package as possible, that when we spent a dollar, if we had limited dollars to spend, because keep in mind, Senator Manchin was also pushing down the top line, right? He said you can only spend so much money. He wanted to have a bunch to pay down the deficit. He wanted to have it fully paid for. There was lots of politics around Senator Sinema and pay fors. So they had constraints, right? So if they only had so many dollars, I think that they were maximizing for two things. And that's just my hypothesis from conversations, but other people could obviously speak to that directly because I wasn't in the negotiating room. But my understanding is they were really maximizing for cutting as much pollution as they could with the dollars that they had and making sure that they also kept the environmental justice provisions that were in the Build Back Better bill. You know, I haven't looked at every single line item from the first bill to the second bill. I know in general what happened, some programs lost the full amount of their money. So like they went from, let's say, a $10 billion program to a $5 billion program, right? They were cut in half, but the program was still there. Other programs were cut entirely from the package. So, for example, Senator Sanders and the Sunrise Movement and Senator Markey and others really championed something called a Civilian Climate Corps, which was an idea to create jobs for young people, sort of restoring communities and like a Peace Corps, but for the planet in the United States. And that was unfortunately cut from the package. One thing that I was a little sad to see go was electric bikes. There were there was money to help everyday people get an e-bike. Now, the good news is e-bikes are actually quite affordable, so hopefully people could just buy an e-bike, but it would have been cool to have that because I know people were excited about e-bikes. So, you know, there was a kind of a blend of some things falling out entirely, but most of it, I would say, was more reducing the top lines as opposed to cutting programs altogether. And then, of course, other things that happened were Senator Manchin added some things that the environmental movement doesn't agree with.
I want to get to that in a bit. So staying on what's in the bill.
Yes.
And let's go through some of those provisions. What do you think are the most sort of, I guess, helpful in terms of ultimately bringing down the amount of carbon emissions?
Yeah. So, the tax credits for wind and solar and batteries for cleaning up our electricity system have a huge bang for your buck in terms
and
the, of
and those are consumer facing or
no. Okay. Those are for companies, whether it's utilities or what we call independent power producers, which are companies that make electricity. It's for them to build huge amounts of wind and solar, what we would call utility scale projects, right? So that's like, you know, the grid is a massive, huge engineering feat. You know, sometimes people think it's like the biggest machine in America, the electricity grid, right? And so how do we clean up that grid? It's really critical to clean up that grid. There are programs to help get wind and solar and batteries deployed at a massive scale. And then, you know, apart from the pollution cuts, we also have to think about the political economy here, right? So there's $60 billion to build made in America technologies, clean energy technologies that are the 21st century industries of the future with good paying and hopefully unionized jobs because they got some of those great good paying provisions in there. You know, that's going to change the politics because now we're going to have clean energy jobs in every district in this country, in every state in this country, and maybe the Republican Party won't just be listening to the fossil fuel companies giving them massive amounts of money. Maybe they'll start actually thinking, oh, shit, or I don't know if I'm supposed to swear, oh, shucks, we're getting money from, you know, clean energy companies, and we got to do what they want, too. We've got people working in our district for clean energy companies. So that manufacturing stuff is going to really shift the politics.
When you say hopefully union jobs, is there any type of requirement, provision, encouragement?
Yes, a lot.
Okay, how does that work?
So there are provisions that say it needs to be prevailing wage, for example. There are also additions for so those tax credits that we're talking about. If you do good paying jobs in a project, you get extra money from the government. So there are incentives and requirements to do more good paying prevailing wage jobs. And I got to say, you know, those were provisions that folks were a bit concerned might fall out, because remember, this all had to go through reconciliation and the parliamentarian, and there are very strict rules about what is budgetary and what is not, and can we put requirements for like prevailing wage and good paying jobs in the bill or not? Well, thankfully, the people who worked for Senator Wyden on the Finance Committee are absolutely brilliant, and they worked really hard to figure out a way to do it, and they got through the parliamentarian. So yes, there are incentives in this bill to really start building not just jobs in the United States, but good jobs in the United States.
But not necessarily union, right? I mean, theoretically, if I can say it's a prevailing wage, you could also say you get... we could encourage unionization too for these jobs, correct? I mean,
yeah, I don't think it goes quite that far. You're right. But, you know, it definitely goes in a direction that can be supporting unionization. And I'll say for specific industries such as offshore wind, there's a lot of effort in trying to make those industries unionized. And, you know, there are efforts to try to make sure that, more of our car manufacturing of electric vehicles is unionized too. And some of the automakers that are moving in that direction, of course, are actually unionized shops. So, you know, we're going to see more of the clean energy jobs being unionized than we've seen in the past. And that's actually been part of the problem here. And I got to say, that's a huge underrated success in this moment. When we tried to pass the Waxman-Markey bill 13 years ago, the last time we tried to pass a big climate bill through the Senate, the unions were not supportive. There's a whole book about this. It's called Carbon Captured by Matt O'Mildenberger, my colleague at UC Santa Barbara. And we had a lot of opposition from unions. Guess what? That hasn't happened this time. Like, the unions are actually supportive. And that's really important because, you know, there have been really important things put in this bill that think about the transition. There are, for example, programs to help help former coal mining communities get clean energy jobs in their communities, right? So an actual sense of a transition for workers. There's also money for the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund, which is something that the United Mine Workers, which have traditionally been very opposed to climate policy, they actually were supportive of Build Back Better because of some of these provisions. So, you know, it's going to tilt things towards unionizing more of the clean energy sector. And that's really important because historically we've had higher unionization rates in the fossil fuel industry than in the clean energy industry. As you know, the clean energy industry is a newer thing. It's still growing, but we want to make sure that going forward that we have higher unionization rates in the clean energy industry, that we have good paying jobs. So, and that's going to be really important, not just for everyday families, but also for the politics of this, because we need unions to come along and be part of the 21st century clean energy industries of the future.
I don't want to get too far ahead on the Manchin stuff, but one of the concerns that people have is that even if there is a net, not a significant sort of like, I guess, undercutting of the purpose of this bill, which is ultimately to diminish the amount of carbon emissions, even if that's not the case, and we'll get to that in a moment. But it still sort of puts frontline communities and folks who are most vulnerable in the path of these really dirty processes for extraction of energy. What is in the bill that deals, I mean, you've sort of touched on it, you know, on a top line manner, but most specifically, what is in the bill that will impact communities that are basically been subject to some form of environmental racism or, or deprivation, whether racism or, you know, as a function of wealth?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, folks may remember that the negotiations fell apart. Senator Manchin walked away. I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, really infuriated with him for doing that. Lots of groups spoke up about how terrible it was that he walked away. Well, it turns out after that weekend, he actually went back to the negotiating table, maybe because people were calling him out. I don't really know why he did or didn't do it. I actually think he had things in the bill that he wanted passed, and he had actually spent a lot of time working on this, and walking away from all of it was probably not good for his politics too. If you have the United Mine Workers saying that you want this bill, you know, that means something for him maybe. Anyway, he went back to the negotiating table, and it was all secret. Nobody knew it was happening. I didn't know it was happening. Not a soul knew it was happening except for Senator Schumer's staff and Senator Manchin staff. And as far as I understand, they were told not to tell a soul. They were told not to tell their like partners, their significant others. So it was a very, very secret thing. And then Wednesday of, I don't know, 2 weeks ago now, where, what is time? Out of nowhere, this press release goes on Senator Manchin's website saying the Inflation Reduction Act, which was never the name, by the way, right? This is a new name, is, you know, he's for it. And like all of us were like, what does this mean? So it turns out that during this time period, you know, he did a bunch of stuff to the bill. They came to agreement on things. Some of it was not great. Some of it was good, whatever. He put some bad things in the bill during that window of time when nobody was involved except for Schumer and Manchin. What are some of the bad things?
Well, I want to get to that in a moment, but I'm curious as to what is in there to protect frontline communities.
Oh, you want the protection side?
I want the protection side first, then we'll talk about the Manchin stuff.
Yeah, so there is $60 billion of environmental justice support in this bill. So I mentioned some of this, I think, but maybe not. I'm doing so much media.
I understand.
What is time? So there is money to clean up ports, $3.5 billion. Ports are overwhelmingly, in communities of color. There is $3 billion for community block grants for environmental justice communities to set their own priorities. There is something called the Clean Energy Accelerator, which is basically a green bank that will help communities like set their own projects. Like, let's say there's a public housing project, and they want to insulate or put in a heat pump or put a solar panel on their roof. There's a green bank that will help them get access to low cost capital to do that project. And that is for $27 billion. And it's a bank, right? So I think it's revolving, meaning you could lend the money out, it can go back in, it can keep going. And 55% of that $27 billion is tagged specifically for disadvantaged communities. So the majority of it is for that. There are also programs to help low and moderate income folks get access to a heat pump, an induction stove, a hot water heater. And the cool thing about those programs is that they're not tax credits, they're rebates, so you don't have to be wealthy. And for low income folks, they actually, which is defined as 150% of area median income, so like pretty, you know, decent for that, they can actually get like the full cost of this technology back up to a certain limit. So like $8,000 for a heat pump, for example, that's like a lot of the cost of the heat pump.
And I'm sorry, 150% of the median income in a specific area code or?
So that's just for this very specific program I'm talking about right now. That's not for all the things that I'm talking about. So there's different definitions of what does it mean to be disadvantaged in different parts of the bill, et cetera. But anyway, the cool thing about that one program, which is $4.5 billion, it's something that Senator Heinrich championed, as well as Senator Smith. It's going to help low income and moderate income folks get clean energy technologies, like potentially for the full cost covered. So, you know, there are different programs that do this, and they add up to about $60 billion. And, you know, there were some EJ groups, environmental justice groups, that were involved in helping create these priorities. There's money to do air pollution monitoring and things like that. And the Equitable and Just National Climate Platform, which is a coalition of some EJ groups and some big greens, you know, they worked to set some priorities and actually got a bunch of stuff in the bill. So that's what is sort of in the bill when it comes to the good things from an environmental justice perspective.
And two more sort of, I guess, perspectives before we get to the Manchin stuff. Okay. One is, so you mentioned a couple of things in there that I think essentially once this is passed, we're going to, you know, people in our audience are going to be able to access.
Yes.
Maybe in a couple of months, let's say you want to get an inductive stove instead of your gas stove in your apartment or your house, I guess you can get that. If you want to get a heat pump, you can get that. And a break on an EV car. Is there anything else that specifically people are going to be able to feel within a month or two? And then on the other side, what about like technologies like hydrogen or ones that are, you know, maybe a little bit down the road, but need encouragement in the same way that maybe solar did 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah. So when it comes to consumer-facing incentives, you're right. There is money to help folks get a heat pump, a heat pump hot water heater, to upgrade their breaker box if they need to rewire their house. There's money to help people get an electric vehicle, including a used electric vehicle, $4,000 off of a used one. There's money to help people put solar on their roof. Some of these programs come through tax credits, meaning you need to actually owe the federal government money. And that's unfortunate because historically, it's wealthy Americans who have been adopting a lot of these clean energy technologies because they're tax credits. That's not the best thing. However, there are also these rebate programs, and I worked pretty hard on some of those rebate programs. They're not perfect. I wish we got more money. Let me tell you, we really wanted more money, but I'm excited because we think that the $4.5 billion in that program, that's a rebate program, is actually going to help electrify 1 million low and moderate income homes in this country. So that's really exciting. I feel really proud of that. And, you know, those are some of the things that people can really see and feel in touch. In terms of other sort of newer technologies, those aren't really as much consumer facing. Of course, believe it or not, you can also get a hydrogen car. We don't talk a lot about this. There are hydrogen cars. They're not really popular compared to electric vehicles, but there are incentives for that too. If for some reason you want to get a Toyota Mirai, as that's probably the most popular hydrogen vehicle out there. So, you know, there are also incentives for that kind of a clean car if that's something you want. For the grid scale hydrogen stuff, you know, there's lots of controversy around hydrogen. There's different colors of hydrogen, green hydrogen, purple hydrogen. I mean, not actually, it's not purple. It's blue and turquoise. And anyway, I won't get into the weeds. It's very weedsy. But yes, there is money to develop that technology. That technology is actually more like a battery. So by which I mean it stores energy, right? So like, let's say you've got a lot of wind and solar at the middle of the day. It's like sunny. The wind is blowing. You're making so much electricity. And you know that the grid has to be perfectly balanced in terms of supply and demand at every second. So let's say you have too much supply. What are you going to do with all that? You need to store it. So you can put it in a traditional battery, like a lithium ion battery at the grid scale, or in a house. Or you can also put it into hydrogen, which is basically using a chemical process to store it in like a chemical form. That actually takes a lot of energy to do that. So you lose, because it's a conversion process, so you lose a lot of energy in that process. So it's not necessarily clear how much hydrogen will be used or how important it will be. I think that time will still tell on that specific issue.
All right. So let's get to the mansion provisions. It basically call for making these some of these government investments in alternative energies, or sustainable energies, contingent upon opening up federal leases to oil companies, essentially. And then there's also like sort of some bypassing on permits for pipelines. One that just happens to be in West Virginia as well. I want you to give your assessment of those things, but are they in a separate bill? In other words, like, because it seems to me there's an opportunity here for folks in the House to sort of pull what I would call a mansion on mansion here. But let's talk about, like, are they in separate bills? Like, are the provisions I just said, are they embedded in the IRA? Because they don't impact the U.S. government's budget very much.
So there's some of them are and some of them aren't. So let's talk through that. So the parts that Manchin stuck in this bill are the leasing parts. Okay, so that is a requirement to offer a minimum amount of onshore and offshore lease sales on public lands every year for the next 10 years. Offering lease sales is a very, you know, political thing. Biden stopped doing it. He then got sued. The federal government got sued. They lost. They now have to do it again. Like, lease sales are a bad status quo thing. And what this bill does is it locks in the status quo, and it does it in a particularly stupid way. I got to say, like, it's a dumb, bad provision. It says that in order to do clean energy on public lands and offshore, like build an offshore wind turbine or put a solar panel in public lands onshore, you also have to offer a lease sale for bad stuff for fossil fuels.
How much money is associated with that? Because I just like,
you know. It's about $500 million is, I think, what the CBO score is. So from a money perspective, it's not big in terms of the overall scale of the bill.
How is that? How does that fit? How does that make it into the reconciliation bill? Like, where is the parliamentarian? I mean, there's been many provisions, it seems to me, that have impacted the budget more than $500 million, $500 million over the course of, you know, what presumably we're talking 10 years. I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, that doesn't.
Well, I mean, the parliamentarian, I mean, I'm not the parliamentarian, as you know, I don't know what's in her head or what, why she calls things one way or the other. I think we should also ask, like, why we have to go through such an absurd process, because we haven't gotten rid of the filibuster, which, you know, makes the Senate, really,
we could fire her too. I mean, yeah, I'm old enough to remember when George Bush did it when he wanted to lower
taxes.
That's
true. Well, I couldn't fire her and you couldn't fire her, but no. Schumer could fire her. So
that's correct.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, I don't know why she made the call that she did. People were definitely wondering if this particular provision would go through the parles or not. It did survive that. I wasn't in the room, so I again don't know. But yeah, this is a bad provision. It, from a money perspective, it's a small thing. But there is another thing that was part of this, which is that they changed the royalty rate for extraction on public lands. They increased it. So maybe that's part of the reason why it's budgetary. Keep in mind that also cuts against fossil fuel developments because it makes them less profitable. And, you know, what does it mean to hold a lease sale? I think it's important to just understand what we're talking about. We're not saying all this land will be developed, all this offshore stuff will be developed. We're saying the federal government will hold a process where they will auction off leases. They'll say, would you like to buy some stuff to ruin, to poison people and communities? Would you want the option to go do that? And companies have to say, yeah, I would. I'd like to buy that. They actually have to bid in. And we've had some lease sales where basically nobody bid. And in general, what my understanding is about 1-3% of the area that is actually offered tends to actually be leased. And then once somebody buys the lease, they then have to go through a process of environmental review before they develop the project. So this isn't like all this acreage will be a project. It is saying that we have to offer the ability to do a project. That is bad. It is bad public policy. It is bad for communities. It is bad. But I just think it's important to understand, like, what are we talking about? Anyway, that is in the bill. It is bad. It is not good. There are also additional provisions in a sidecar, we could say, in another bill. It is not what's happening right now. We've not seen the bill. We don't know what's in the bill, really. Like, there's been some reporting of a fact sheet that was leaked by Manchin's team. But I don't know what's in the bill. Like, the bill is not out there currently. But what has been discussed is the approval of the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which is probably the worst part of what's in the other part, the sidecar, that I am opposed to. There is discussion of changing the environmental review process for projects. And then there's this hypothetical list of like specific projects that would maybe move forward already of different energy types. No, I don't, nobody knows what's on that list. So we don't really know what this is yet, I would say. We have some inkling of it, and the things that we do know, like the Mountain Valley Pipeline, are bad. But keep in mind that, let's say the House passes the Inflation Reduction Act this Friday, which I hope that they do. I think that is good for people on the planet and Americans. I really do think that. Keep in mind that then perhaps we have a moment to try to work together to stop the other things that have not actually passed yet. Those things have to go through 60 votes in the Senate. That's harder to do, right? We got to find 60 votes. 60 votes for anything is like damn near impossible. And we even have some Republicans, maybe they weren't being honest. They, you know, sometimes lie. I don't know if you knew that. But they've been saying, well, they won't vote for that stuff if the Inflation Reduction Act. But they might have just been saying that strategically to try to tank the Inflation Reduction Act. But anyway, that bill's not on the table yet. We don't fully know what's in it. I think a lot of environmental groups are going to be opposed to it, and work together to try to stop it. But we don't have the information yet. And you're right. There could be a big moment of leverage once the Inflation Reduction Act is passed to try to kill certain parts of that bill. But I don't know. It hasn't happened yet, obviously.
Yeah, you mentioned leverage as it relates to Manchin, but I was just wondering if we could return to some of the tax credits for electric vehicles and things like that, because you mentioned how more people are going to buy these things, prices will naturally go down because of the tax credits moving the market in that way. Are there any guarantees in the bill that hold, I don't know, say, industry accountable to create mechanisms for electric vehicles going down? Because they also could just not go down.
Yeah, so what I was talking about is a really common finding from research, primarily in engineering, but also in economics. It's called learning by doing. It's a really kind of ironclad law, I would say, of innovation, which is that the more we make something, the better we get at doing it, and the more the costs fall. Of course, you know, if you have monopolies, that might not happen. So you need to have competition and things like that. But it's a pretty ironclad sort of law, we could say, of innovation. So, and by the way, we're already seeing it in these technologies. Solar and wind have fallen huge amounts. I wish I knew the numbers off the top of my head right now, but I don't. Like, they've fallen in half or whatever. Like, they've fallen huge amounts because we've deployed them. Batteries are starting to have that same process play out because we're making more batteries. Heat pumps are going to have that process play out because we're going to make more heat pumps. So, you know, we see this pattern all the time. Wind and solar is cheaper. If you put solar on your roof today, it's infinitely cheaper than if you put it on your roof 10, 20 years ago. So I think that that is going to keep playing out. And it is already happening in electric vehicles. Keep in mind, the first electric vehicles and the way Tesla even thought about it as a company was that they would market first to really rich people, these luxury vehicles that cost like $80,000. And they would use that manufacturing process to get enough money so that they could make a mass market vehicle that was more like $30,000, $40,000. And so, you know, that has been their theory of how they're going to make mass market EVs. And, you know, Ford and GM and Chrysler, or whatever their new name is, they're all saying they're going to turn to EVs as well. And there's actually been $180 billion in private investment dollars going into electric vehicle manufacturing in the past few years. So,
yeah, you know, but there's no mechanisms, right? It's just incentivization.
No, there's no like price controls or something like that. No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, except if you just take the tax credits on their face, they reduce the cost directly, right? So they make it cheaper just directly. So I guess that is a mechanism for making EVs cheaper.
Okay, well, Leah Stokes, professor of climate energy policy at University of California, Santa Barbara, thank you so much for giving us a rundown on these numbers. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. A lot of people are saying that we can now get a some type of tax credit on getting a new
a breaker box.
Very good.
Just in time.
We're working on it, folks. I mean, people should understand. This is not my office. I mean, it's our office. I don't own it. If I owned it, I would be, you know, punching holes in the wall and both out of anger and to set up the breaker box, but I can't do that. We should also say that, like, you know, there's definitely differences of opinion on this bill. And Stokes mentioned that the Climate Core, which was championed by the Sunrise Movement, was taken out of the bill. As far as I know, the Sunrise Movement still supports what ultimately passed here. So I think there's, you know, I think it's very easy to get caught up in the idea like this is the biggest thing that we have ever passed. And it's probably the only thing that we've ever passed in terms of climate.
Factually, so, it's true. It is the biggest thing we've ever passed
is.
For climate change.
And look, if you measure it through just the very top line, of like, and it really does depend on, you know, what you perceive to be the point of a bill like this, which is reducing our carbon emissions. There's a bunch of different ways in which you can go towards that. And this is obviously because of the nature of our government and our society at this point, like one of the most sort of market-based ways that you can do it. Now there is a huge amount of government investment involved in this, and the returns are there in terms of emissions,
So I was trying to get at.
We see the returns in terms of emissions, but we're not necessarily there in terms of like what we get beyond that.
And well, we saw it from the CHIPS bill too, right? Which is just like, you know, we want to do, that's more of a straightaway giveaway where we're going to give billions of dollars for this kind of manufacturing. This gives it, puts it more in consumers' hands, I guess. But I feel like there's a lot of, you know, faith in the market and demand side economics there that is, I don't know. I hope it works. I just want, you know, that to be fleshed out before we hail this as the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Yeah. And I think like, look, it's hard to assess what impacts our what will impact our politics in terms of like having the oil industry maybe not as prominent 10 or 15 years ago, 10 or 15 years from now. Maybe, you know, Exxon is at that point, like they have transitioned into solar and wind. And they have outsized influence on our government because they're an outsized corporation. It's very hard to assess these things. In an alternate world, but one, and this was never in Build Back Better, we should also remind you, in an alternate world, the U.S. government says, we're not going to incentivize people to build solar farms. We're going to build solar farms. And we're not going to incentivize people to provide a prevailing wage. We're just going to pay a prevailing wage.
And to the extent that we need fossil fuels, we own those industries now, and we decide that. It's not based on the whims.
Exactly. There is a lot of, like, but that's not where we're at. And
remember that Rumsfeld quote, you go to war with the army you have?
Exactly.
It's like you go to war with the Democrats you have. And this is what you would expect from the Democrats we currently have.
Yes. And with that said, like, look, if we can get to 50% reduction by 2030, that's a big deal. It's a big deal in terms of like the sort of the one of the primary concerns, which is try and help the world not go through a massive, massive upheaval in terms of civilization.
Yeah. Also, no hovercrafts included in this legislation, which sucks.
No hovercraft. That's right. All right.
E-bikes are starting to sound interesting, though.
Mm.
I never really
Dorsey
thought about those.
Was talking about his, and it sounds pretty nice.
Oh, I've ridden. I don't have one, but I have a friend who has one, and the pedal assist thing is pretty nuts.
Mm.
And I have another friend who has one that looks like a motorcycle. It
That's
has pedals,
about.
But it looks like a motorcycle. And he took the thing that sort of makes you not go fast.
Yeah,
the limiter.
The limiter off, like with an app, and it goes like 40 miles an hour.
He better watch out, or Eric Adams is going to run it over with a bulldozer.
Can you still tie put a baseball card in the spokes?
Well, I think they should. To be honest with you,
because they're quiet. Yeah.
They're too quiet. And when you get one of those on the bike path, it's like, you know, all of a sudden, like, it's on top of you. You don't even realize it. I think they should.
Is that what those baseball cards are for? It's to let people know you're coming?
No,
that's just to be cool.
Sound like a motorcycle.
Yeah, that's just to be cool. But, like, I don't think – I wouldn't put baseball cards necessarily. But, I mean, I think you
– I'm a girl. We had baskets with little flowers on them on our bikes.
And the frills off the handlebars?
Oh, yes.
I still had that, too. And then I put the baseball cards on. And then – folks, we're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member of the show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help this show survive and thrive, but you also get the free show, half, free of commercials, and then you get the fun half. If we get enough members today, I will buy a dedicated power source, a DPU or whatever it is. Those things are expensive. They're expensive batteries. Matt, what's happening on the Matt Lekien Media Universe?
We'll be talking to Ben Spielberg more on the half loaf of the IRA and where the other half of that loaf keeps going to. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. Also, we might have a... a little announcement to do with a Left Reckoning store tonight. So look out for that, folks.
Whoa.
Wow. Shoot. I couldn't find it.
I'm getting my hat. I should have a hat tomorrow and a tank top, so we'll be modeling tonight, maybe.
Wow, that sounds that's I assume.
I've installed a catwalk in my apartment.
That's going to be available on your OnlyFans page too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
OnlyFans.com/MattLack.
646-257-3920. 646-257-3920.
Gotta learn how to smize, Matt.
See you then.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Boo.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon!
Fun. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. Talking
oh,
for
wow.
a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me. Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go for a
walk. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about
yeah.
you is just like every day, all day, like
yeah.
everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.